Later on, we'll take phone calls with Nick Begich as we talk about mind manipulation. Up next, Harp, what is going on there? Stand by on Coast to Coast AM. And here we go with Nick Begich. Nick, how many years have you been talking about Harp now?
Oh, I wrote the first, my first article I wrote in 1995 for Nexus Magazine, actually. And so it's been a very long road, 17 years now.
Explain to people brand new to the show, what is HARP?
HARP is the High Frequency Active Rural Research Project, which is originally was joint project of the Air Force and Navy and the Geophysical Institute in here in Alaska, the University of Alaska. And then it shifted over to DARPA, actually, in 2003. They took control of the project and research. But it's an array or field of antennas that there's 180 antennas in the array. It creates radio frequency energy that is focused or concentrated into a relatively small area, and then they're able to manipulate that energy to affect the ionosphere, this energized layer above the Earth that begins about 30 miles up, and the magnetic field lines, these lines of energy that flow, the magnetic field lines that flow from the South Pole to the North Pole, and they're able to utilize the RF, the radio frequency energy, to create a variety of weapons effects, from things like over-the-horizon radar, being able to look around the curvature of the Earth for incoming objects, to even manipulating the chemical constituents in the upper atmosphere, for instance, for knocking out pollutants or affecting ozone levels. And then some of the more interesting and esoteric are the weather modification aspects, and then the physiological aspects of RF on human beings. What can you do with radio frequency energy, even at very low densities? And what can you do to increase energy by sort of tapping into the energy of the planet? And HARP actually does that. It doesn't just use its input power, but it manipulates energetic areas within our environment for military applications.
As technology has obviously gotten better over the last 18 years,
right,
Has HARP physically changed at all?
Well, there's several things have happened. First of all, the antenna designs changed a bit. The power supplies changed. You know, as the technology advanced in terms of computing power, all of it. I mean, from the fiber optics that are used to drive the system to the controls that operate the array itself. In fact, there were some rumors after one of the programs, I think it was the one we did back in August, I had heard stories that perhaps HARP was down, it was shut down, and all of this kind of stuff. On the 13th of, around the 13th of February, it was probably just a few days before that, I was flying out of Alaska and had an opportunity to shoot some film with the History Channel on HARP. They're doing a segment that will be coming up sometime in the next several months. But we flew out by helicopter, actually, and circled the facility a number of times to get some film, and it is fully active. There's no question it's still operating there. A full team was on site, and they actually had to shut down when we entered their airspace because that's the regulations. It's not restricted airspace, so we can do it, but it makes them all very uncomfortable when they get nervous,
huh?
Well, when an A-star shows up and it's knowing that they've heard this coming, they get a little upset. But the problem is they're not granting interviews anymore. And so why not? Well, they say it's an open program, but the reality is, and I think time has told the truth here, another change at HARP is it's no longer an open program except for every other year when they do an open house and provide their dog and pony show for high school kids. But when you look at the shift, it started back probably the late 90s. They started cutting back on their media dialogue, and it's primarily because it was CBC-TV. We had given a technical memorandum that was not supposed to be released to the public that they were able to use in preparing for an interview with the program manager and the main guy that dealt with their public relations, and he got caught lying on film, which, you know, doesn't play very well.
That's not smart.
You know, and so they ended up hiring a new publicist, a guy named Garcia, who's been doing most of the work since then. And then they just shut down the communication. And that's what happens, is they say, oh, it's all open. But then when credible news organizations try and get even Spiegel TV, which is the biggest in Germany and Austria, they were denied interviews on the excuse that there was no one available at the site. And then they went up to the site anyway just to film. And this is, again, quite a few years ago. And there was a full scientific team on the site. They just wouldn't talk with them. Jesse Ventura, when he went up to do filming, and we had done a segment with him for his series. And he was denied entry, you know, both at the gate and in advance of his arrival there on the same kind of excuse. And, you know, I think that's what ends up happening. You know, you got to have a story when you got in the middle of the wilderness, this huge antenna array. You got to have an explanation for it, and it's got to pacify your population. We just created a lot of controversy because we brought out the information, and then as time went on, Dr. Eastland worked with us and cooperated with us on to the extent that he could without violating, you know, his either secrecy agreements with ARCO, which later expired, and then of course his understandings with the U.S. government, because some of the projects he was involved in were classified.
How many people work at HARP? Do you know?
It's not so much how many are there. I mean, it's because the facility is open to all branches of government, many academic institutions. If you really measure the number of people that utilize the facility for experiments, you probably count them in the hundreds because it's used as one of the premier facilities. It's a developmental prototype. It is sort of the leading edge in this area of technology, drawing researchers from a number of disciplines, a number of fields, and from a number of countries. And eventually it all gets now rechanneled through DARPA so that all of that research can be looked at. And it's, you know, it's a compartmentalization method that our country has always used, which is the idea of breaking things down into small bits so no one really gets a full picture of what's going on, and then you reassemble them at some higher level or different level of government. And that's the role that DARPA plays in many of these research projects.
Why is it so secretive?
Well, the implications are pretty profound. I mean, if you think about manipulating weather as an example, I mean, it was Rumsfeld that talked about when he was in Washington about abandoning the environmental treaties that don't allow us to manipulate weather. And his rationale was we had evolved the technology so well that we could literally control the battlefield before it was a battlefield. In other words, we could create such huge natural or appearing to be natural disasters that we'd be even invited in to clean up the mess. That, you know, that's a big shift where you can wage a covert war. And Rumsfeld was big on covert war, for those that remember, you know, along with Cheney and a bunch of these other guys. And they'd been around for a very long time in government. And government, and they go back to the Ford administration, which was, you know, if you remember all the controversy that got us Ford for president and almost got us Rockefeller for president when the assassination attempt on Ford was made. But when you go back to look at sort of where these guys came from and what their mindset is, again, these are functionaries, these are bureaucrats underneath the system. But here they are, all these administrations later, still driving the truck for U.S. policy. They're not even elected. They're not even appointed with a review process. Most of these guys are selected, and then they are become the manipulators, the handlers, if you will, of the politician. And that's exactly the way a lot of this stuff evolves.
Do you think chemtrails, Nick, might be involved with HARP in some form?
You know, a lot of people are talking about it, and there's a variety of reasons why I've stayed out of that issue. Could you use chemicals or compounds dispersed in the environment and then affect them with RF? And the answer is absolutely yes, you could. In fact, during the break, I randomly turned to a page that gives some of this in one of my books. It was, and this book was the one that's gotten the least attention, but it's really got the most information on a lot of issues on privacy, is Earth Rising, the Revolution.
Yeah.
And I'm quoting, it was the Southwest Research Institute. It was a final report on biotechnology research and requirements for the aeronautical systems through the year 2000. Okay, now that's a while ago. Now this was prepared for the Air Force Office of Scientific Research all the way back to 1982. And this is what they were saying about RF as an example. Being able to, they say, define the ability of RFR, radio frequency radiation, to interrupt, degrade, or direct the human central nervous system functioning. Define the ability of RFR to interrupt or degrade physiological functions such as cardiac output or respiration. And then three, define the ability of RFR to interact with chemical or other physical agents and to assess their combined impact on humans. Now, what can happen with RF, you can send, and this is the stuff of HARP, you can send energy in that is specifically designed to weaken the human system. And so you send it in advance of combat, and then you disperse on a very wide variety, a very fine biological or chemical toxic agent that right. for people entering the battlefield that weren't like highly sensitized to those constituents before the battle began, those are the ones that become the victims of the technology because their systems have been broken down, recoded to accept to be better receptors for those biological or chemical agents, causing dramatic changes in those troops and yet not affecting anyone else. And you can use RF to accomplish that. So HARP could be used for that kind of activity, essentially sensitizing your adversary in such a way that you can then introduce something that's not restricted by convention, but has the same damaging effect to human health. And that's exactly what this area of science and advancements in this area are all about. The other issue that goes along with it, and this is in that whole realm of non-lethal weapons, and one of the papers that was put together by a couple of majors some years ago, they looked at it from the standpoint of, hey, this is the perfect weapon because we're no longer going to have to deal with the media. And this was their big concern was, you know, that somehow that the media made warfare really horrible and terrible. I mean, come on, war is horrible and terrible. I don't care what context you put it in. And the idea of a free press to report on it is fundamental to democracies. That's and democratic right. republics. The idea was to sort of take that realm of tissue tearing and destruction and change it so you don't really see the visible effects of warfare, the things that play well on CNN or Fox News, but you actually can take and look at the scenery. Everything looks normal, properties not damaged, people appear to be at least breathing, living, and not torn to shreds. But the fact is you can influence populations in such a huge way. It's the perfect weapon if you don't want to have to do reconstruction after the fact. And military leaders look at it as the best way to manage public opinion by essentially utilizing a different approach to warfare that takes the visual horror of war out of the equation. We've done the same thing by going to remote warfare, using drones as an example. The idea that you can play like a video game. In fact, even animate it like a video game. And you get these kids that are really good. They're going into military service. They're maybe sitting in the middle of the United States running drones in some foreign place, killing hundreds, and yet they don't have the attachment to the action that they've created. Now, on the one hand, I can understand that. But the other hand, it takes away the dimension that we've always experienced. After a war, as victors in the wars that we've succeeded in, and even those that we have not succeeded in, our men and women come back and do everything they can to avoid war, to make sure war is always the last stop, not the first stop. The way things are changing, it's becoming too easy to make it the first stop. And that's, again, when you look at the whole population issue of propaganda and the moving of populations, the conditioning of people to respond to emotional charge, the same things that happened in Germany can happen here. In fact, I think that's a big fear of government right now, in the sense that there's a very highly agitated population in this country for a lot of very good reasons. But how that energy gets turned at some point, one charismatic leader, one change of events could explode this country in a way that no one would ever expect. And the hope is it explodes in a contained implosion where we start to look within our country and start to reexamine our institutions, starting with reexamining ourselves as individuals, creating the changes that we individually need to make so that we can press forward and insist on those kinds of changes within new institutions, within new creations that are much, much different and a very, very high level of accountability. And that we don't have in government. Accountability and government are running in two separate directions. It's become a game of polling, propaganda, and spin. And people are sick of it. I don't care if you're in the Tea Party movement or the anti-Wall Street movement. the same dissatisfaction in government is popping up, not just in this country, but all over the world.
Everywhere. If you stood in front of HAARP and they were able to beam and bombard right at you, could it kill you?
Yes. If you were in the center of that beam at full power, absolutely. And the thing is, it's pointed up, and so you got what are called side lobes. You have a certain amount of energy that just sort of leaks out of the system that affects those that are within close proximity. The reason you have to shut down, one of the reasons you shut it down when aircraft is in the area, is because it'll interfere with fly-by-wire electronics, where you're controlling electrical controls with an aircraft that are done wirelessly, and then you have RF interference, you see, and then that's why you turn your cell phone off when you get on a plane. Now imagine something with an effective radiated power of a billion watts, you know, not a few watts of a handheld cell phone. So this is a big issue, and that amount of energy focused, and then again, you know, you start to change even the side lobes. If you are pulsing that energy at specific pulse rates that correspond to biological functions in people, you can have profound effects with very little energy just by capitalizing on resonance effects, the effect of building the energy based upon its correspondence with cell size, for instance, or even on a smaller level, atomic level, you can create resonances that are quite profound with very little energy.
Do you think cell phones could really, though, Nick, affect a plane?
I don't think
they could. You know, here's one of my reasons. You know, I travel a lot, and I'm sure there are people who don't shut their phones off. Maybe they put them in their purse or their wallet or their suitcase, but they're not shut off.
Right.
And nothing's happened to the flights. And if they could disrupt flights, it would be the simplest tool for a terrorist, wouldn't it?
Oh, of course. And I think, again, you know, this is, you know, it doesn't take a lot of energy. I don't want to get into what it would take to create a device, because I don't want to have that.
No, you don't want that on your
but let me say, it's very simple. And the fact is, it's so simple when you start to think about it. But you would have to know enough about the dynamics, the shielding of an aircraft. I mean, the amount of knowledge you'd have to have going in is not the standard portfolio of information for a terrorist. At the same time, a lot of money and a lot of resources. Terrorists aren't just independent individuals. They're states. They're governments. There are governments working actively to create technologies for future war. I mean, the Russians haven't slowed down. Yeah, we have a cooperative arrangement with them these days. China hasn't slowed down. We have a cooperative arrangement with them. But most wars start when the creditor nation wants to collect. And, you know, going back to the Middle Ages, you know.
So true.
And that's why the financiers of wars always financed a little bit on both sides, so they always had a collection agent. And that really was it. Otherwise, they always got they were left holding the bag. They had made the loans, but what they lost was their head, not just their money.
Good point. And
that really is it. Nothing has fundamentally changed. I mean, if you think about even what's going on in this country in terms of sort of our, I think it's a revolution in at least thinking that's beginning to happen and take various forms. But that's the kind of revolution that has to happen. We have to change ourselves to change our world. We can't accept the existing paradigms. We can't accept the existing conditions as just something we have to live with. It only takes a few, and I think that's what we have to recognize.
Yeah, that's all it does. Nick, when we come back, let's talk about the specifics of HAARP, earthquake enhancement, whatever it might do. We'll be back. Well, next hour, we'll take your phone calls with Nick Begich. You've heard what we've been talking about, but let's get into HAARP when we come right back and find out what Nick thinks it's being used for. We'll be back. And welcome back to Coast with Nick Begich. Nick, let's look at some various areas here and tell me what you think about the possibilities of HAARP and its use. How about earthquake enhancement, being able to create earthquakes elsewhere?
Yeah, you know, this is a possibility. In fact, there was a quote, and I've used it often, and it's one that, again, shows up in the book Earth Rising, the Revolution, and it's by Secretary of Defense William Cohen, and it goes back to 1997. Now, this is pre-9/11, and it says, and I quote, Others are engaging in an eco-type of terrorism whereby they can alter climate, set off earthquakes and volcanoes remotely through the use of electromagnetic waves, using energy as a way to stimulate energy within the Earth. In fact, I have a very dear friend of mine, Elizabeth Rauscher, who is a well-known astrophysicist, a geophysicist, and a biophysicist, and she is under contract to my company to produce a book on earthquake prediction. And this is kind of, to predict an earthquake, you have to understand a lot more about the underlying mechanisms. But it's based on her research over a number of decades, and we'll be bringing that out sometime in the next, probably towards the end of the year, the beginning of the following year, because she's down to the final stages of writing, editing, and finishing up her compilation. But this idea of earthquake generation by using energy itself, it goes more or less works like this. You take earthquake along a fault zone like along in California, and you have micro earthquakes occurring almost all the time. I mean, you can look at any of the databases on earthquakes. You see these small ones that occur that are releasing energy. Where you get concerned is when you don't see any energy releases along known fault lines, especially big structural faults, because then you know the energy is building up there and eventually will release. The idea of using electromagnetic energy is to be able to stimulate through resonance the premature and directed release of that energy. In other words, instead of letting it come out in small quakes scattered over time, to try and get it at a specific place to release that energy that's naturally occurring. So it's, think about it as a primer on a bullet. You know, it delivers a little bit of energy that then releases a larger amount of energy in the gunpowder. And the Earth is the same way. The heart produces what would be looked at as a little amount of energy that acts as a triggering mechanism to release vastly larger amounts of energy. And so earthquake generation is certainly a possibility. The idea that we can do this, in fact, it was, I think it was Venezuela and China that blamed the U.S. for the Haiti quake.
That's right.
Others have held the U.S. responsible for the Japanese tidal wave and associated earthquake. You know, these are now possibilities, and because the science is here, people are always asking the question, you know, is it HAARP or is it some other technology being used? The fact is, the Secretary of Defense believed terrorist organizations had this capacity. We do have this capacity. Whether we've used it or not is, you know, one of those, someone else's disclosure, because I'll guarantee you, wherever we've used this technology, it's going to be a very long time before we find out the results of that work, much in the same way as the downwinders in terms of atomic experiments in the last century.
Okay, so that's that possibility. What about controlling our minds?
This is interesting because it's, again, as a there's a couple of applications. One that deals with what's called earth-penetrating tomography, which is, in a comparison or an analogy, would be like X-raying the Earth or looking into the Earth, although X-rays particularly aren't involved. But the pulse rates involved are 1 to 20 hertz, or pulses per second, vibrations per second, which correlate to the predominant brain activity in human beings is in that 1 to 20 hertz range. You see the alpha rhythms, which are associated with focus, creative, intellectual states, the low beta rhythms associated with normal walking and waking states that most of us are in. Here at this hour, we're probably hitting lower alpha and maybe dropping into theta and falling asleep, dropping down. But the point is that FFR response that I was talking about earlier, this frequency following response, HAARP, when it's operating within these specific ranges, the human brain will begin to follow that. It'll follow that and begin to show up in brain activity. And so, you know, can it? Yes, it absolutely can, as a side effect or a deliberate effect. With DARPA's interest in large systems for mind effect applications, I'm sure this has not been missed. In fact, it was Persinger at Laurentian University back in 1995 wrote a paper on exactly this topic, suggesting that, and he's a researcher in mind effects for those that that don't know his work. He was using magnetic solenoids for affecting the brains of people, gave them all kinds of experiences, from out-of-body experiences to UFO abductions using magnetic field coils. And there's a lot of debate about what was actually happening there. But what Persinger said is if you could introduce a signal into the environment that would create that hypersensitivity or agitation of people, and then just broadcast a press release into the 6 o'clock news blaming some ethnic group or some individual for the cause of all your problems and ills, a certain amount of that anxiety would turn in that direction. It could be as simple as that, according to Persinger. On the HAARP side, you've got the ability to do this on a hemispheric basis, a very, very large area. Networking transmitters, which there's a number now across Canada and across Europe, you could create a profound effect on population. Would government do it? I think so. I think it was a big new Brzezinski back in the 70s that wrote a book called Between Two Ages, where he talked about mind effect technology and requiring to happen on a global scale or a hemispheric scale. You would need to be able to create a stimulation of the ionosphere and utilize that stimulation to create a signal that would then return to the Earth that would affect populations. He actually published that while at Columbia University before he was at the White House as National Security Advisor Jimmy Carter. You go back even further, and the work that he based his assumptions on was a geophysicist at UCLA, J.F. Gordon McDonald, who had this idea that we could do this. We just didn't have the technology in the 60s and early 70s to achieve that. HAARP delivers on that technology. So, yes, we can do this.
That's pretty dramatic stuff. Who do you think invented HAARP? Who was the person?
It was Bernard Eastland, absolutely Ben Eastland. And Dr. Eastland, initially, the military denied that he had been involved, but eventually it came out. And once his secrecy requirements with ARCO expired, he was still alive long enough to have a more open and broad dialogue. And, you know, Eastland was brilliant, and he has, I think, 19 patents before he died. He had mostly as a plasma physicist, that was his big deal. He, in fact, designed the major components for the Pentagon air handling system to knock out biological agents using using essentially ultraviolet and very, very sophisticated designs to knock out virtually all of the biological agents. Now, you can imagine how much air volume flows through the Pentagon. It has to be a very efficient system to do it. But he was a versatile physicist. He was a participant in our closed conference on mind effects, as I had mentioned earlier. And I consider Ben Eastland a very, very good human being. And what he got involved with was HAARP. Wasn't to do some sinister act. He did not have any biophysics. He had none of that background to understand the physiological implications. But when he became aware and he took the time to educate himself, he recognized that as a serious threat. The weather modification issues were the other area where he was no longer willing to provide data to the military in that area because he felt they would abuse it and they would be reckless in their applications.
He was right. Do we know who physically built it?
It was built by a number of subcontractors. I mean, they were, going from the gravel paths, which were native subcontractors, up to specific engineers and aerospace contractors for the antenna design and construction. But it was essentially U.S. Military contractors.
Well, and it continues. And there's another HAARP system in Europe, right?
Right, the ISICAT system. In fact, Tromsø, Norway is associated with that that facility. It's run by the Max Planck Institute from Germany, although it's in Tromsø. And if you remember that very weird visual, what was it? It was
that like spiral. That
right.
Spiral. Yeah.
Right. And we had believed that that was potentially the Tromsø transmitter or a transmitter similar to it, because it's exactly what you would expect in certain applications. In fact, here in Alaska, they used barium-laden rockets to inject barium, very fine particulate barium, into the magnetic field lines above the Earth, and then used HAARP through a method of cyclotron resonance to focus, sort of corkscrew that energy into those field lines. And because of the barium that was present, they were able to get a visual image of that corkscrewing kind of motion along the field lines. The thing observed in Tromso was similar in the sense it was, I believe, mapping field lines from that broadcast facility. And that's my opinion, and I want to make that clear. It's my opinion, just given the circumstance, location, and no other viable explanation that I've seen yet.
Well, it's pretty dramatic stuff, isn't it?
It is. You know, at the same time, you can understand the headiness of scientists involved in this research because, you know, they're each so specialized and focused.
They get
really excited about the science. And then when they see the broader implications, some of these folks move a different direction. Others become quiet, and they're stuck. I mean, as people are, for all different reasons, fall into circumstances that maybe if they'd got the broader picture, they might not have participated in. And our hope always has been, we've always been open to discussions with anyone involved in these projects. And our hope is that the very brightest of the bright will see a better path and a better way than just fueling this military-industrial complex. Yes, we need a strong military. Yes, I want the United States to be in the lead. As long as we carry the moral character that I think we've let go adrift in some senses recently.
What if it's been created to knock out an asteroid or something incoming, like a missile?
Now, this is great because actually it was Russian research coming out of Strategic Studies Institute in London that identified this potential for us the first time. And what it is essentially HAARP these facilities are also referred to by military as ionospheric heaters because they can literally heat the ionosphere, which is this layer that begins 30 miles above the Earth's surface. They then push that layer out maybe a couple hundred miles beyond that. And what happens is the lower atmosphere rushes in to fill that void. Now, incoming objects, when they come into the atmosphere of the Earth, most incoming objects, they immediately begin to burn up because they're traveling at tremendous velocities, and the friction creates burn. And so most objects burn up before they ever hit the ground. But they've got about 30, 40 miles to accomplish that. If you could quadruple that, 160 miles, 200 miles, 300 miles out of atmosphere, then much, much larger objects could be literally burned into nothing before they'd ever hit the planet. And so the Russians believed, in fact, they offered to cooperate with the U.S. in the early 90s in this area for asteroid and comet mitigation because people began to become concerned about near space objects. In fact, when I was in Hawaii, it was earlier this week, I had the opportunity to meet with Dr. Ritter there at the University of Hawaii and talk to him about some of that ongoing research. And there is some great stuff, and people get excited. But I think we've got to exercise a great deal of caution, particularly in weapons development today, again, because of the lack of oversight, the lack of scientific knowledge in the Congress, the lack of accountability. And, you know, the role that I've tried to play in the last 17 years on HAARP, on mind effects, on some of these esoteric areas of privacy has been as a journalist, more than anything else, is someone taking the time to put that material together, make it available to people, and as an activist, because I take the position that I have an opinion, I have a position. I take the information, I provide it in a way that hopefully will change policy, will change the way this stuff works. I don't do it passively. So in that sense, I consider myself an activist. But this is where things change, and I think the challenge for all of us is to take the issues that are important to us, learn what we can, be as accurate as possible, and then get that information out to the public. And you'd ask me how long? 17 years on the HAARP issue, and I would not retract one single word from what Gene Manning and I originally published in 1994 in the book Angels Don't Play This HAARP, because the only thing that's happened in 17 years is we've been proven correct. Anyone who's read any of the articles I've written, the papers I've written, and the predictions made in there based on the evidence and the footnotes, over 1,600 footnotes in four different in-print publications, will know that those predictions made even a decade ago, two decades ago, show up as accurate absolutely accurate today, and not based on anything weird or esoteric, just based on analysis of a lot of information and then coming to rational conclusion that turn out to, in fact, to be proven correct.
What do you see right now, Nick, as our most pressing issue that affects us as humans?
It's the shift in consciousness. It's the opportunity of changing individually. You know, all the things that I've reported on, all this external stuff, it all still boils down to human beings making decisions, making choices. It has to do with the fact that when we make those conscious choices, the other thing that I know from my research, that the mind affects area, when military planners ran into it, what did they find? They found that every human being had the potential for these anomalous human capabilities, what we used to call extrasensory perceptions, ESP, these kinds of things. Think about a fully actualized population. That's the greatest challenge. Our objectives as human beings on this planet are to awaken ourselves and to assist in the awakening of others. And in that awakening, this planet will change. And that is the only way it will change.
Well, let's hope so. What are you working on next these days?
Well, you know, I've been doing a very different kind of writing. And it's more oriented around the topics we just covered here in this last few minutes, this idea of awakening. You know, it's, in this work and in going back to the very beginning of my work in this area, it was my interest in improving human potentials and the possibilities that can come from that. I'm shifting back to that direction, recognizing that all of this work in the last 17 years is illustrative and useful in helping educate the public on those possibilities. But from my perspective, I'll still be reporting on all of the things I've reported on in the past, but my greater emphasis is going to be on transformation. What does it take? What can we do to enhance our possibilities? What can we do to enhance our individual and collective possibilities to become the kind of creatures that we were created to become? And I think we're linked in a way that provides that huge possibility. I think that's what it's about. I think that's what my work has always been about. Technology is a metaphor for me of what's possible, man stretching to what nature already can do. Within ourselves is a huge capacity that's still untapped. That's the biggest capacity for change. And it's not going to be in the old way. The old paradigm of fight or flight and warfare as a solution, that is not the solution. That is the problem. It generates more fear, more anxiety, more worry, which suspends, as we said in the very first hour, our ability to reach our higher states of consciousness and awareness. We need a state of calm, strength that comes from within each of us, that can drive us forward in a way that doesn't destroy but builds, and builds ourselves while we build others. That's what changes the planet.
And it changes it dramatically, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, think about the collective force of that. I mean, and you guys have done some things on Coast over the years where the audience, you know, you have a million people focused on something for a second, you know, because the mind is fleeting. But if you can hold that, one of the tricks of all of that, you know, why did that work so effectively? You know, you maybe held a thought for, let's say, 30 seconds. So you had a million people for 30 seconds holding a thought of the cumulative power of that. If you think about it as an energy unit, 30 seconds, you had a 500,000 minutes. Try and hold your concentration as a human being for 5 minutes on one topic. You can't do it. So you end up, you know, the trick is you revisit each thing over and over again. But when you have a million people revisit the same instant, the world can change. You can change by changing ourselves and finding the resonance in each other to change this planet.
We're going to take phone calls now with Nick Begich. Final hour on Coast to Coast AM.